Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
Thanks for selling your car to Carvana. Here's your check.
Whoa, when did I get here?
What do you mean?
I swear it was just moments ago that I accepted a great offer from Carvana online. I must have time traveled to the future.
It was just moments ago. We do same-day pickup. Here's your check for that great offer.
It is the future.
It's the present and just the convenience of Carvana. Sorry to blow your mind.
It's all good. It happens all the time.
Sell your car the convenient way to
Carvana.
Pickup times may vary and fees may apply.
SportsGrid.com. Betting insights and entertainment at your fingertips 24/7 as our team covers the most important topics in sports wagering. Real-time odds, predictive betting models, expert picks, and more. Want the edge? Then get on the grid. SportsGrid.com.
Alrighty, are we live? Yes, we are. Welcome to the Color Up Podcast, where today I'm going to ask you a question. What if you had unlimited credit in a casino to play craps? What could possibly go wrong? Would it mess with you? But we're going to find out today because it really happened right here, right now.
Welcome to the Color Up Podcast. Whether you're a seasoned player or a beginner eager to step up to the table, this is your lucky podcast that's all about the thrill and strategy of the casino world. I'm your host, Jeremy. With me is Jim the Professor. Let's get rolling.
All right, Jim, this is going to be an exciting episode. I am going to bring in a retired international attorney, now author of the new book, Mr. Z, and that is Don Zarin. Don, welcome to the show.
Good evening. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. So we read this book and we're like, we've got to have you on. This is, well, not only because we're a craps-centric gambling show, but this story was just dynamic. So I don't know. We have a lot of questions, a lot to get to. And man, we're just excited to have you on and talk about one gambling, one craps. I mean, just this huge scandal. There's just it's crazy that this is a true story that you've actually authored here in your book. And so I don't know how you want to get into this, except for maybe just give us a quick synopsis, too, because I want to be careful of what we don't want to give away in the story as well. But maybe just we could start there.
Sure. That sounds great, Jeremy. And again, thank you for inviting me. Yeah, let me give you a thumbnail sketch maybe of the key pertinent part, the gambling part. But first of all, as you said, it's a true story, and it's really about the biggest scandal in Atlantic City history. What I think is special about this book is that it provides really the rare insight, maybe the only time I've ever seen it in a true story, of what casino officials were actually thinking and doing while they were enabling my father, a compulsive gambler, to become one of the biggest gamblers in the world in Resorts Casino in Atlantic City in 1980. After everything collapsed, there was a lot of litigation, so I was able to get my hands on a lot of documentation, all of the casino records, and importantly, the testimony of casino officials. So I actually have the behind-the-scenes look of what was going on. But let me just sort of summarize in 2 minutes. So after college, he began gambling. He played poker. He loved the race, the horse track. I went to the races all the time. I grew up at the racetrack in the 60s, early 70s. He owned maybe a half a dozen racehorses that he raced up and down the East Coast. And he went from time to time to the casinos in Vegas and to resorts at a casino in the Bahamas. In all of those times, there were guardrails. So, for example, in the 60s, when you played poker, you usually lost the money you came with. When you went to the racetrack, they didn't have ATMs back then, and you lost the money you came with. And if he went to Vegas, in fact, in the mid-60s, he went to Vegas, he hit a $50,000 credit limit. That's about $500,000 today. And it took him maybe 3 or 4 years to pay that back. He was also a housing developer, and when Congress passed what was called Section 8 subsidized housing in the mid-70s for subsidized housing for senior citizens, for low and moderate income housing, He built the first Section 8 housing in Pennsylvania. So when casino gambling came into Atlantic City in 1978, resorts opened on Memorial Day 1978, he saw the need for housing. So he brought his team down in the spring of 1978, and he became one of the most successful businessmen actually in Atlantic City. So Memorial Day opens. It's really great crowds, great excitement. They break all records for gambling revenue. On June 11th, he comes down to Atlantic City. Resorts had given him a small, they had comped him a small suite because of his gambling in the Bahamas at resorts. In fact, in 1973, I think he owed them $20,000. He couldn't pay it back until early 1978, but they comped him nevertheless. So on June 11th, here's how it sort of starts. He gets a $10,000 line of credit. He signs a $500 marker, and he places a $25 bet on the craps table. Over the next 18 months, he becomes the largest customer at resorts. His credit line goes up to about $200,000, which is about $1 million today. They give him the Frank Sinatra suite, which is the, he only has to leave that if Frank Sinatra comes into town. That's his home, that's his office. He has any access to any boutique, any restaurant, as do all of his guests have access to all of that. They give him a limousine. The following year, competitors start to come in. Regency Casino opens in the summer of 1979, and they start to go after my father for his business. So Resorts gets really nervous. They don't want to lose his business. In fact, Regency takes him on a yacht to the Bahamas in December. So at the end of December, the casino officials come together and they say, well, what can we do to keep Zarin as a customer? And they say, first of all, let's go see how much he lost over these 18 months. So they have a red book that is a diary that they keep of all major players of estimated wins and losses. So they look through the red book and they find out that he lost $2.5 million over that 17, 18 month period. That's about $12 million today, but it's really a lot more than that. Back in 1980, there weren't that many millionaires. Today we have a lot of billionaires. So he was a big customer to them. So they said, well, what can they do? So they had a discussion. They said, well, Zarin really hates all the credit limits he keeps hitting. What if we give Zarin unlimited credit? So that's what they decide to do. So early January in 1980, they tell my father he has unlimited credit. And by doing so, they remove the last guardrail that he's ever had in his life. And it's his dream come true. It's the dream come true of every compulsive gambler, every craps player, as you said. So here's kind of what happens over the next 4 months. He starts playing on January 4th, and for the next 4 months, not every day, but almost every day, he plays 12, 15, 17 hours a day at the craps table. They raise his credit limit at the end of January to $2,500 a point. So the way my father played, he would put $2,500 at the pass line, $7,500 behind the pass line, and $2,500 on every point. So he had between $20,000 and $25,000 on the craps table on almost every roll of the dice. That's over $100,000 in today's terms. So you've got this, the casino officials are watching this out of control gambler, has no sense of time, his only interest is to gamble. He wants to keep signing checks, he signs casino checks, he signs personal checks, he's afraid they're gonna put his credit rating back, put his credit limits back. For him, each roll of the dice is this intoxicating cocktail of anxiety, euphoria, hope, regret. Crowds surround the table four rows deep, yelling and chanting, Mr. Z, Mr. Z, every night for 4 months. And he becomes, over those 4 months, the biggest gambler, I think, in the world, at least on a sustained basis, if not one, certainly one of the biggest gamblers in the world. The point of my book, though, is what were the casino officials saying and doing? And I think this, to me, is why this book is significant. They're reporting up to the president every night, telling him his wins and losses. The vice president for operations says, I've worked in casinos my entire life, and I've never seen any gambler play like Zarin at such sustained high levels. I just wonder how much longer he can keep it up. The credit manager says, well, nothing goes on forever. It's just a matter of time before Zarin runs out of money. But don't worry. Either way, we'll get paid. He has a lot of property and a lot of assets. They tell the president Zarin won't be able to keep gambling at such high levels. The president lets it continue. At the end of 4 months, as you guys know, everything collapses. And when they do an accounting, they find that he signed casino checks and personal checks totaling $16.7 million. That's about $75 million today. $12 million clears, and he owes the casino $4.5 million. That's a rough summary of the essence of that story.
And there's so many different side stories to this, too. So you have David Zarin, the successful businessman. So he's obviously he has means to gamble and stuff. But in the context here, you got essentially just Las Vegas is where you go to gamble. But now you're on the East Coast opening up Atlantic City, right? It's the first casino. And so he's essentially the first whale or first, you know, high roller there, right?
Yes.
Because they're opening and he's there on the forefront of it. And so he has the money and he just starts playing. And obviously, I mean, it's an addiction. He got addicted to it in a very short period of time.
He did.
And,
he did.
Yes. So there's so many parts of it to where, you know, people can get addicted. It is a thing. You know, I think Jim brought up a stat that like 1% can become compulsive gamblers, but the casinos played a huge part of that. And in the book, it explains, you know, how they continued to enable this, let alone, you know, he had a mistress that also, but such a fascinating story that, man, I don't even know where to start. Jim, where do we,
I think it's not just your dad's story, it's your whole family story. And that's the thing that gets me. But you guys sounded like you started off typical middle-class home. And your dad got pretty successful. I believe he was an engineer, was one of his first businesses, I think, right?
Yes, he was a civil engineer.
And then he moved it from that to the housing. And your father, and you did a nice job in the book, he's the first guy who really starts developing. He's a visionary. He looks in the future and says, hey, we need some housing for the older people. They're getting older. And he starts to develop housing, and he's able to do that very successfully. And that's like the generator for his initial big wad of cash, that enables him to have the income to, like you said, do those Vegas trips and get down to the Bahamas.
It did, but bear in mind, as a compulsive gambler, there are a lot of down periods. So as any major gambler, as any compulsive gambler, there are really ups and downs. So, I mean, he would give my mother an allowance, but then he would ask for it back a week later. And so she would stash it at her sister's home a couple of miles away, knowing that was going to be needed. So she was trying to, you know, juggle all of those issues. And, you know, he owned horses in the 1960s, early 70s, but then he had to sell everything in early 1972 when business started to go bad and he had some downturns in the gambling world. So it's a definite up and down world. I'd also say, you know, back in 1980, that was the first time that the Psychiatric Association acknowledged compulsive gambling as an illness, as an addiction. Mm-hmm. Up until that time, it had not been acknowledged by the Psychiatric Association. We as a family did not understand it until everything broke apart.
So the main bulk of this story revolves around just a real short period of time, a couple year period of time where he got super excessive into gambling. But I know before he owned horses and, you know, you guys went to the track all the time. Did you see or know at that point? I mean, obviously we didn't, like you just mentioned, we didn't even know what compulsive gambling was. But you kind of noticing your father always gambling, going down to the Bahamas, the casinos, what's available at the racetrack. Did you think like this is abnormal or there's a problem, he does this too much, or was it kind of under control for him?
I thought it was under control. Obviously I didn't know, you know, the extent of his losses. I did know when he went out to Vegas and lost $50,000. I was actually out there with him. I was about 13 or 14 at the time, so but I didn't know and understood the compulsion. I enjoyed growing up. We went to the racetrack every weekend. During the week, I skipped school and would go to the racetrack at night. I loved owning racehorses. You know, what a treat. We had a horse that was going to enter the Derby, the Kentucky Derby, mm-hmm. and then it chipped its bone coming out of a gate like two races before the Derby. And there we were in this sort of movie scene, you know, down at the stables. What are we going to do with this horse? No, it was, for me, a fun lifestyle. And I was just at the racetrack yesterday. In fact, I still enjoy that, although I don't go very often when my wife lets me go.
So I could see, and you do mention where you kind of, it was almost an intervention where you were kind of finding out towards the end where it was a major problem, but I could see where it was hitting, because maybe you could talk a little more about this. So much of it was because he had success in business. There was so much of, yeah, he was playing and losing, but then he would go back and forth. The money was just shuffled, kept going in circles, shuffling between the mistress, his businesses, the casino. He's moving money back and forth between the casinos. So it's like he lost track of all the money, but I could see where no one else was like, well, he's a successful businessman. He could afford this. And it just got even beyond his control. So talk a little bit about, you know, the shuffling of money.
Well, sure.
That
I mean,
was really,
he had a mistress who had a room, a comp room right next to his, although they stayed together. You know, when we would ask him if he, you know, what he was doing and can't, you know, get control over it and stop it. He would always say, you know, I have control. Leave me alone. I know what I'm doing. I've made a living, this much of a living. I can handle it. His mistress, at his request, took out credit. And when she would take out credit and they'd give the chips to him. So she had a credit line that added to his credit line.
That's crazy.
And that had never happened. I mean, the casino in doing all this violated so many different regulations, then they got into a lot of trouble after everything broke. But what really, I think the really key part when he lost control was this 4-month period when he was mm-hmm. signing checks. He had no idea how many checks he was signing, but he was worried that his checks wouldn't clear. So the casino had agreed to cash for him non-gaming checks, which he was supposed to use for non-gaming. And the first time they did that was like June of the following year. I think they cashed $50,000 and he took it up to his room. Yep. 2 hours later, he came down and used that money to gamble. But during this 4-month period, he was cashing non-gaming checks, $50,000, $60,000, $80,000, $100,000. Or when he would win, he wouldn't redeem his markers. He would put it in a safety deposit box. So yep. The next day, and a couple of times a week, he would walk to his local bank 3 blocks away with about $100,000 in cash in a paper bag and deposit that at his local bank. Now, $100,000 then is worth about $450,000 today. Imagine going to your local bank with $450,000 in cash 2 or 3 times a week and depositing that much money. So he was doing that to cover the checks that he knew he had written but had no record of what he had written. So all he wanted to do was gamble. His sole obsession was to gamble. And so he was doing whatever he can. But that was the scene that was taking place during that 4-month period when things really got out of control. And the casino was watching all this. I mean, they would walk him with his money to the safety deposit box. They even had a security guard standing near him when he was playing so no one would take any chips while he was gambling. So, and then you had, again, as I said, this crowd four deep yelling, Mr. Z, Mr. Z, all night. This was going on for 4 months.
Well, I was just, I mean, Jim introduced the show, like how, you know, we think as gamblers, how awesome it would be to gamble with like no limit. Like, oh, I lost. Hey, can I just, I'd like to sign for another 10,000. I'd like to sign for another 100,000 and just keep going and going. So obviously that would be super thrilling, but at some point it must have become miserable for him as he can't win. It's, you know, at some point you mentioned like he knows he's down. He don't know how much, you know, millions, right? And he's like, now he's just trying to catch up.
It's all
so it couldn't have been fun, right? He's just like, I got to catch up.
There's
I got to
no
catch
fun.
Up.
No, it's no fun.
No, I think, I mean, after the third month, he was exhausted. He hadn't slept very well. I mean, as a craps player, talk about unlimited credit. I think this has got to be one of the best true craps stories ever written. I don't think any craps player has ever I mean, craps players dream about having unlimited credit, and putting your maximum. I mean, he was betting the maximum amount at every point and behind the pass line and on the pass line as much as he could. So no, he had no control. He wanted to stop. He was actually egged on by his girlfriend, who wanted to maintain the relationship, and her relationship was through the casino. So there was, you know, there was many, many twists and turns. And then after everything collapsed, you know, then there are half a dozen twists and turns that take place after that, because he got into a lot of trouble. The casino got in a lot of trouble. The attorney general wanted to suspend the resort's license. He was, I don't want to get into the whole story, but he was in serious criminal trouble, got out of that, got his business back on track, and then ended up having one of the most important tax court cases in U.S. history, in fact, which is taught in every tax school, in every law school in the country these days.
So one last gut punch, the IRS coming, right?
That was the last gut punch, that's right. I mean, I think this story for me, as I was writing it, I envision a Netflix-type series. This was really, this belongs as a limited series. Netflix would tell the story better than the book does, because the cinematography around the casino and the personalities involved are what really make the story.
I want to talk, if you don't mind talking a little bit, about the devastation that this type of gambling had on your family. I know, because I love the book. It's great. But there are so many relationships that were messed up. And yet, for whatever reason, your family stuck together and made it through. But you talk about your brother who passed away. At one point, you said their relationship was never the same after that going forward. Talk a little bit about your brother, your sister, maybe, if you can. Maybe bring in mom, because your mom is a saint.
Sure, I'd be glad to. Well, let me start with my mom. I guess I would describe her as sort of the 1950s stereotypical housewife. Her greatest joy was being a mother, and she was really a great mother. She was loved by all, very warm person. She was the most popular mom on the block. And she was a very smart woman, but she had zero interest in business, and she hated confrontation. And so that was a big difference between her and my father, who was always looking for someone as a partner who could understand business. And he gave her a really hard time. He was very, very difficult with her, very confrontational, and it was very, very difficult for her. My brother, Richard, who was 5 years older than me, and my sister's 5 years younger than me, so there's three children, was really her protector, and really stepped in the way sometimes if there was some big arguments taking place. But then later in life, when my brother didn't like confrontation either, he ended up working with my father, because when he built all this housing, he set up a management company to manage all the senior citizen housing that he built. And my brother came in and became the president of the management company. And that was a difficult relationship. And then as he watched my father really lose control over his gambling, he saw his business and his family's income at risk. And that was a great difficulty for him. For me, and for my brother, we watched a train wreck coming when we saw this going on. We tried to stop it. We knew we couldn't. I thought my father was going to lose the money that he was making, and I figured he was making about $2 million. When we learned at the end that he had written checks totaling $17 million, it was a bit of a surprise for us, and obviously. When he got into trouble criminally, I took a leave of absence and I worked on his criminal case for quite a few months. And we moved home to try and put the family back together again. But yeah, there wasn't any, there was no judgment on my part. My mother really had the toughest part, because she found out about the affair and her husband had lost all this money. So it was obviously devastating for her. But we all came together. We tried to get my father out of his mess. And for me, I don't think I made any judgment about him. It was just really, how can we help him? We really all united, and there wasn't any recriminations in the family. It was really, let's get him out of this mess, which we ultimately were able to do.
And one of the things that I know, you were very close to your dad and not your father. Again, your brother Rich was the protector of your mom in the book. But when your dad finally got it together and he said, hey, look, I'm going to go to Gamblers Anonymous. I think if I remember correctly, he asked you to go to the first meeting with them.
He did.
Is that correct?
He did. That was a difficult time, to be sure, to follow that, to listen to that. But, you know, then, you know, there's a whole redemption part to his personality and what happened.
Yes.
Then it took him a while, but he then acknowledged that he was an addicted person. He became the chairman of the National Foundation for Pathological Gambling. He went around the country speaking on behalf of Gamblers Anonymous. He was able to get the state to give a grant to the foundation, $200,000 a year. He donated money to Johns Hopkins for beds for senior citizens. And it was really interesting to see him make that turn. And so one of the parts about the book that I like, and I probably wouldn't have written it otherwise, is that there's a real redemption element to him that I think was really positive and tells a really positive story at the end.
And I think you're right on that. This is a movie because it has the perfect arc where the successful businessman then becomes, and you do such an amazing job in the book of building this tension of like, when, because you know it's going to explode because he's, you know, he's writing checks he can't cash, and then he's depositing money to cover, and just the gambling scenes you describe, he's just intense gambling, and the bad guys of the movie are just continuing to take advantage of him essentially because they're like, raise his limits, let him keep playing forever and ever. So you know it's coming to an end, and it does, but then you get this whole redemption story. So it is the perfect movie. It would be amazing to see it made, but maybe we can work, help, you know, I don't know. Let's get this out. Let's get a screenplay done. But yeah, just the fact that there is a redemption in it. Well, it's almost like two endings. Cause then, like you said, it seems like everything's finally, you know, the family's coming back. He's going through Gamblers Anonymous. His business is becoming successful again. And then the IRS, you know, one last, coming in at the end to kind of ruin the lives again and scare everybody again. I don't have a question in that, just the idea of it does wrap up into such a compelling story. I would recommend anyone out there to definitely get the book. We're going to link it in the descriptions of that thing. You can find it on Amazon, just called Mr. Z. So it is a compelling story, and just the fact that it's a true story, obviously you have all the facts and details. You have to add some narrative to move it along. The part of his redemption is, I think you said he never went to the casino again.
No, he never, he never gambled at the casino again. He was so afraid that he was going to go to jail. Whenever he started to think about the casino again, his stomach would turn. I mean, it was actually, he had a claustrophobia, so going to jail would have been a disaster for him. And so but he did go to the racetrack in later years. But, you know, we would go, because he moved down to Atlantic City after all this.
Yeah, that was what was crazy about that, the whole thing. He goes, moves back, and I'm screaming, no, no.
Exactly.
And yet he did it.
That's right. You know, he wanted to continue his housing. He had lost the Frank Sinatra suite was his home. He had lost that now, but he wanted to continue to build housing there. And so he convinced my wife to move back, and they rented an apartment in Atlantic City. And he really didn't gamble anymore. We would go, when we visited him, we would sometimes go to some shows, and you have to walk through the casino to get to some shows. And he actually did that. So
wow,
it's a rare instance of a compulsive gambler that actually cured himself through this, really what was a topsy-turvy, really terrible period that he went through.
And how old was he?
Just one more thing. There were really two personalities. And I think I try to bring that up. There was David Zarin, the housing developer, and there was Mr. Z, the gambler. And as David Zarin, the housing developer, I walked through some of his projects and how he did that, and how his A1 personality sort of got him through some of those things, and how then Mr. Z took over, which he was called at the casino.
And
how they would switch back and forth, and that continued. And then, you know, I guess he finally got rid of Mr. Z when all this fell apart and broke, and then he recovered from that.
Yeah,
how
Jeremy
old
was
he
ask
during
how old,
the peak of this?
He was in his mid-60s. 1980, he was about 65.
And so, okay, after he quit gambling, how long did he?
He lived till about 84. So he after he quit gambling, he continued to he went back to Atlantic City. All his cases were dismissed, and he then became the leading businessman of the year award from Atlantic City. He became really, again, built all this amazing housing in Atlantic City and became very successful for the next 7 or 8 years. And then, as you mentioned, the IRS case came along, and that put a turn on everything. I don't want to get into the whole book, but it's an important part of the story. Should I talk about that a little bit, or what do you think?
I think we can leave it just as a tease. Yeah. I mean, definitely you want to find out that whole another huge part of the story for sure.
But historically, can I ask you a question about the PTIs and the TTOs? The PTI was what gave your father, kept him out of prison, basically. And it was, and I think it said in the book, it was the first time that it had been used for gambling, for people with gambling.
Well, for sure.
It wasn't originally designed for that.
PTI is called pretrial intervention. My father was criminally charged because when everything fell apart, 93 checks came back.
5 years each one, right?
5 years each one. He was charged with 93 counts of fraud. And can you imagine the headlines in the newspapers in Atlantic City, Philadelphia, even the New York Times had a few interesting tidbits about that. That was pretty actually tough as a family to go through. And no one understood gambling. This was the first casino. So the attorney general was convinced this was fraud, that he was skimming, and he wasn't. The resorts checked all the checks and understood he wasn't. This was all lost at the casino. He testified, in fact, in front of the grand jury because he wanted to educate them about compulsive gambling, that he had really no intent to defraud anyone. And ultimately, he convinced the attorney general that that was the case. And they have a program in New Jersey called pretrial intervention. And if you get admitted into that, you go for a 1 year of probation. You have to do things like go to Gamblers Anonymous, a bunch of other things, voluntary service and things like that.
Community service.
And then at the end, they dismissed the charges and then expunged the record. Now, up until that time, the only time they'd ever use it was for petty theft. They had never used it for fraud, let alone gambling fraud. So this was a real dramatic breakthrough. But they were convinced, and I had a chance as working on his case to read the grand jury testimony. And it was clear that the casino knew everything that was going on. There was no way there was any fraud. And the government understood that they could never convict him of any criminal fraud. So ultimately, they put him in this pretrial intervention. After a year, the case was dismissed. His record was expunged. He was able to get financing again for his Section 8 housing and other housing. And he then became, again, one of the leading businessmen in Atlantic City.
Yeah, he created thousands of housing units for not just in Atlantic City, but I know in Pennsylvania, and I think y'all had some projects in Florida and even some on the West Coast. I mean, he was a major player in housing in the United States in the 70s and 80s, and to see it all get away. Now, one other thing I was going to ask you about, because this was kind of driving me crazy. Talk about the TTOs, because this is the thing that I think this is when it really started to spiral and amp up in that period with the leading up to the 90 days, 120 days where it blew up.
Yeah, I was going to add that as recreational gamblers, we understand the casino is a for-profit business and they make business. But at some point, describe the TTOs and how they basically cross the line. It's pure greed at this point where they cross the line criminally and are enabling or, essentially taking advantage of.
Sure. Let me just ask a question. On my screen, I have the host says enabled recordings and got it. Does that show up on your screen or do you just see me without that?
Oh, yeah, that's not on. That
okay. Then I won't touch it. So they have this thing called TTO, which is this trip only. And what it means is if they have a credit limit, let's say you're at a credit limit of $50,000 and a gambler hits his credit limit. But he doesn't want to, he's not writing a check to a personal check to reduce the credit limit down. They can, through the system called TTO, this trip only, give him additional credit for the weekend or for a night. So they say, I'll give you TTO an additional $5,000. So effectively, he's got an additional credit line of $5,000 additional dollars. But at the end of the weekend, when he goes home, he needs to write the casino the check for that $5,000 and bring it back. And they did that to him, you know, early during that 18 months when he was gambling normally, relatively normally anyway. And he lost, you know, they would TTO him for a day or for a weekend. The way they got around the unlimited credit, because they were worried about the regulations, is they said, well, why don't we just keep TTOing him, but not for a weekend, but on a permanent basis. So they effectively TTO'd him for unlimited amounts and never asked him to pay back any of that. Now, that violated a lot of casino regulations. I mean, the casino, not only did my father get in trouble, but the attorney general brought a civil suit against resorts and requested that their license be suspended. So they had a billion, you know, casino must have been worth $1 billion at the time. So they were at risk for well over $1 billion in this dispute that took place between, the, you know, the casino and my father. And, you know, and there was an effort to settle the case. They were unable to settle it. And the casino was under pressure by the Casino Control Commission and the Attorney General. So they felt they had to sue my father just to be able to put on a good face that they were trying to get their money back so that their license wouldn't be suspended. So they sued him and he countersued. And it would have been an amazing trial and case. But unfortunately, fortunately and unfortunately, they settled the case. They settled the amount he owed. And as part of the settlement and as part of his getting PTI, they dismissed the lawsuits both ways. But that's how they misused TTO.
And then another thing that I was going to ask is I don't understand why the casino didn't actually lose any money. Your father was indebted to them. So they extended credit to him and say whatever the big figure was. Why, to me, all the bad publicity of putting the license at risk, like you said, worth $1 billion, and yet they put the screws in, and like they were trying to get all this money out of Pops, and yet they couldn't see the big picture of all the other gamblers that were out there. They just got consumed on your dad and started doing, and I think if I wasn't mistaken, for each one of those counts, they got fined $100,000, and it was $1 million for each time they had a TTO during that.
But for the casino, no, they got fined maybe their total penalty was maybe, I forget, $150,000. They got a slap on.
Oh, it was only 150.
Maybe 200. They had a slap at the wrist at the end.
Oh wow!
So I thought it was more than that. They wanted to settle desperately. They didn't care about the money. And in fact, they had reached a tentative settlement, but they were talked out of it by their lawyer, who said that the Casino Control Commission would be really
admitting
upset.
Guilt, essentially, right? If they settle, they're
admitting guilt, and it would look the press would have a field day. So they ultimately decided not to settle, and then they sued him. Ultimately, they ultimately all settled. So just to get this part out to the audience, the $4.5 million was ultimately settled for $500,000, payable over 7 years with no interest.
So they didn't really care about the money.
They couldn't care less about the money. They just wanted to get out from under the Attorney General and the Casino Control Commission.
Yeah, anything to keep the doors open.
Well, can I ask a question, because obviously Jeremy's channel is all about craps and you don't mention it a whole lot in there, but you do mention some about the way your dad played. One of the things is you mentioned how he set the dice. Are you familiar with the term dice setter or dice controller? Would you consider your father a dice controller or influencer?
I don't know if he believed in that. I think he was very superstitious. So I don't know if he put any words on that they do today, but he would frequently try and get the two numbers the same, like 4 and 4, pick it up. And then he'd sometimes throw it over his shoulder. He'd turn around and throw the dice over his shoulder.
He's not a controller.
Across the table in that regard. His typical betting was to bet whatever his amount on the pass line was, then usually
all the box numbers
and then three times the pass line behind it. And then some amount on the points, and then he would press three times. So before at the end, when he was just betting all the maximums, You know, if he would bet like maybe $500 on the pass line, he'd have then $1,500 behind it. He might have $500 on each point. Then he would press three times unless it reached the maximum on the table already. That was his typical amount that the way he typically played. At the end, when he was betting, when they raised his credit limit and he was out of control, it was $2,500 on the pass line, $7,500 behind the pass line, $2,500 on each point. And then in April, the end of the fourth month, he was buying like the any sevens. I mean, at one point, he had $30,000 on the table on each roll of the dice.
And again, that's in
1980. That's $140,000 today on each roll of the dice. That's what he had.
So he started off in poker, horse racing he loved throughout his whole life and continued, you know, going to the track. But what do you think it is about craps that attracted him or that became his game and that, you know, this whole story revolved around? Because that's, you know, that he loved it so much and was...
He did.
I don't know. What about it?
His sort of thought was when you pick up the dice, all is forgotten. You know, he would say, you know, he would be asked, why do you like it so much? He says, well, it relieves my stress. Nothing compares with the excitement of playing craps. He said a couple of times, playing craps was better than sex. Several times he said that. He also would say when you guys would know this, when you get into a rhythm, when luck comes over to your side, it's exhilarating. And so those times,
euphoric,
when you're in that rhythm, when luck comes over to your side, it was exhilarating for him. And during that 18-month period before the terrible 4 months, he had three big winning moments. He had, I think, one time he won $60,000, which is like $300,000 today. One time he won $100,000, and one time he won $110,000, which was like $500,000 today. So he had a couple of those really big, exhilarating days. But even, you know, obviously, as you said, the odds are against you. You have those big days and you lose it all back. But he loved it. And you know, during those 4 months when he had lost control, he was completely immersed. It was like a drug to him, and he couldn't stop. And the pleasure was so intense, he said to me afterwards that he thought of nothing else. That's true, being truly a compulsive gambler.
So he was a whole different person. I mean, he turns into Mr. Z. I'm not a compulsive gambler. I don't know anyone close to me, so I don't have, you know, the perspective that you do. It is hard to believe to go, because it is such a euphoric game, and that's why we love it. That's why we talk about it and stuff like that. But there is a line that some people cross, and I don't know, you know, you're probably more aware of this than I do, of it could be hereditary. It's just certain people, there's a trigger in them that it gets uncontrollable. I don't know what you know a little more about that, maybe through.
You know, he was a risk taker in business as well as gambling. His whole life was risk taking. So, you know, gambling was part of that.
The risk.
And, you know, during I want to distinguish between the 18 months when he gambled a lot and lost a lot of money. Was he a compulsive gambler then? Unclear. The last 4 months, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting. There was a state investigation that took place 2 or 3 years after all this about the credit system in Atlantic City because of this scandal. And so he testified for a long time at this, I think it's called the State Commission of Investigations. It was probably around 1983. And they asked him if he thought he was a victim. And his answer, I thought, was really, really interesting. He said during the first 18 months when he had lost $2.5 million, he said he wasn't a victim. It was his responsibility, and he takes responsibility. He said the last 4 months when he signed $17 million in checks, he said, yes, I take responsibility, but during those 4 months, I was also a victim. And I thought that was a really interesting comment in terms of his own perspective of what had happened and what his responsibility. He took responsibility the whole time, but it was the last 4 months when the casino gave him unlimited credit, took away all of his sense of control whatsoever, that he was truly a victim. And the casino watched it, and I have their testimony to show what they were thinking and doing during that incredible period. And I think that's really unforgivable as a casino. I don't think it stopped today. I mean, you know, the statistics are not great. A lot of revenue from casinos still comes from addicted gamblers. So this, you know, that's a real tell about how casinos operate.
And the other thing I was amazed, because I, you know, the thing that keeps me from playing a whole lot of time is you know, lack of funds. You know, eventually, like you said, whether it be short term or long term play, you're going to run out of your money. But your dad, through the unlimited credit, he was able to play 12, 14, I think it says 14 hours, whatever, a day. I mean, I can't imagine the misery of signing marker after marker to keep going with the hopes of hitting that big 50,000, 60,000 to get it back and then to, you know, give it all away. It sounds like in the intro you said anxiety, you wrapped up all these emotions, and I was just like, man, that just has got to be a devastating feeling.
It was like a drug. You have to get that drug. You had to get that hit. I mean, he would be almost carried to his bed. You know, he was so exhausted. He'd get up in the morning. He'd be back at the tables at 10 a.m. You know, it was a continuous thing. Yeah. And the casinos are watching that the whole time. And, you know, and you've got this scene of four rows deep yelling, Mr. Z, Mr. Z. But he didn't care about that during that four-month period. He just wanted to play. Mm-hmm. He was oblivious to all that. He was oblivious to the checks he was signing and writing. He never kept a record of any of those checks. He just wanted to keep gambling. That was his goal.
I want to thank you for sharing your story. We'll wrap up. I don't want to take too much of your time. Yeah. But I know Jim will have some final questions, but I do want to just thank you for, I know that you're waiting the timing reasons to kind of finally tell the story and put it out there. So I do want to thank you so much for putting this incredible true story out there. And again, you really should pick up this book. It is a great read and amazing story. And so I want to personally thank you for finally getting the story out and, wow, what a story it is.
Well, yeah. I mean,
thank you, guys. Appreciate that.
Yeah, you're going to have some wonderful leading men and leading ladies dying to play the parts in there. And but, the last thing I was just going to say, it wasn't just your family. It was the businesses, the business partners, and even your good buddy, I think it was John Epstein, your neighbor across the street. Your dad was such a good guy. He brought him in as a young lawyer, gave him some – you know, some lawyerly work, and you guys are still pals even today.
We still are. You're still one of my best friends. So I've known him since 3 years old. So yes, we are still close friends. And his role and his support and his loyalty to my father was unsurpassed. I mean, he did a terrific job as a young lawyer, but you know, he learned. I mean, it was a tough period. I was glad that I wasn't the lawyer for my father during that period.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, but yeah, it's an exciting story. And again, I agree with Jeremy. I want to say thanks a lot for talking about it. But it's a great story, and hopefully it does make it to either a small screen or a big screen, because it is definitely, if you get your hands on this book,
high tension.
Won't be able to put it down like I did.
Yeah.
It's just one after the other. This book right here.
Just the tension, the stories when he's gambling, and then, and then the amazing redemption story at the end is really an awesome way to wrap it up. And I'm happy for your family that all, you know, you guys went through a lot of turbulence, but you came out through the other end one way or the other.
Well, thank you, guys. Appreciate it very much. Really do.
Yeah. We thank you for joining. Check out Dr. Z. Amazon.com is the best place to get it. Or you have a website?
Amazon.com. You can get it. I also have a website called MrZBook.com, and you can get it on that as well.
Thank you for your time so much, and you have a great evening, Don.
Thank you, both of you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. What do you think about that? I mean, it's hard to relate to. I mean, obviously, you have to have access to, you know, in today's money, millions of dollars to get into this situation. But just to have unlimited play and then to get it just overtake you, man,
it's like
just scary.
It's like drowning. I when I was reading it, I felt like the guy was drowning.
Right.
And nobody. His family, certainly not the casino, nobody wanted to help that guy and get him out of there.
Well, part of it is, it's like, I could see the casino kind of had an idea, but, you know, the fact that the business guy, you know, oh yeah, he has plenty of properties and he keeps bringing checks from somewhere, right? But they don't know that, well, they're loans and there is just some mm-hmm. vicious circle of, it is a little scary. And, you know, it is the, It's the bad side. It's the ugly side of gambling, of what we do. So, yeah. You know, I keep it light because that's my personality, right? So I have a channel about gambling, and, you know, I put the little notice below, you know, if you have a problem, but, it's just very difficult for me as a recreational, have fun on the weekend type player.
For us, it's a game. For us, it's a game. Yeah. For the compulsive gambler, it's a drug.
You brought up the story. It's essentially it affects like 1%. It is
an addicted
drug problem. So.
And it messes with their brains. Mm-hmm. And there's an area in your brain. It's the same part of your brain that you get that high on to if you're taking drugs or alcohol. It's the same little section of your brain. And they've done brain scans on it and all kinds of stuff. But yeah, it's this story, and I don't know if for the people out there listening, but if you get a chance, it's a nice little book. Jeremy's got some suggestions as far as the final, Netflix series and some editing. but anyway, I liked it. That's what made it a good book as opposed to not necessarily good video, because he does get into some of the characters.
Yeah, you can picture it, and then he has all the side stories, side characters, and I mean, mm-hmm. it's pretty compelling, but also scary at the same time. Just you kind of end up putting yourself in this place, and it's like the world is crushing you. You're building up millions of dollars of debt. There's nothing you could do to get out of it. Now you got, you know, attorney generals coming after you, the IRS coming after you, the casinos, like they just hung out to dry.
And the FBI. The FBI comes after him.
Criminally, it's like, it's insane. Crazy. And like the fact that he made it through. But yeah, it is, you know, the casinos, oh man, they're dirty. I mean,
nah, not all of them, right?
Well, I mean they're regulated, right?
Yeah, they're regulated. Part of his millions case, of people. Yeah,
part of his case is helped put back into these things where they're overstepping their bounds and
safeguards. They put in the safeguards.
They're providing a business of entertainment, and they're not. You know, you don't have to apologize for that. And obviously, millions of us play, but essentially, 1 out of 100 of us become addicted. And you know how they. You know, they put out their flyers, and do they do enough? I don't know, right? It's tough to say. Do they, you know, my son's a dealer. I've heard some of the things they're supposed to, if you become too drunk or whatever, they're supposed to back you. There are some rules and different things they should do if you're gambling too much. They obviously can't give you unlimited credit anymore, right?
No.
Which is a good thing, but...
Yeah.
Do they do enough? I don't know. I guess I can't really judge that, but it is fun entertainment for a lot of us. But yeah, it's like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know, Jim.
I just can't believe. Yeah, I can't believe his dad would still be able to walk through the casino.
And oh yeah,
that'd be like an alcoholic going to hang out in the bar or something. Bar, I'm not here to drink alcohol. I'm just going to look at.
But
the football
But he was
game.
Crushed so hard, and so much of his life was like. Yeah. At the very end, like, you know, that would be a good reason to be like, all right, I can't do this anymore, I guess, you know. I mean, when you talk about hitting rock bottom to, you know, change your mind on something, he definitely hit it.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, there's so many good storylines in there, but with mom and his brother, he didn't really talk a whole lot about all that stuff, and I guess he's saving that for the series to build up a little demand, but I do think there's a market for this movie if it ever becomes a movie or series. That's there because the story is just so great. And just so everybody knows, I've done a lot of Googling on this, on his dad, and you can actually Google
you can see the lawsuits, the
court cases,
the newspaper articles,
go back and read some of the old headlines and stuff. So yeah, it's a very true story.
We will be back next week
and
we'll see you then. Until then, good luck on Coloring Up.
L-E-T-E-N-P-C.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Nope. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell, and if you know my husband, Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Bye-bye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.